Hello?
Who's this?
Who are you trying to reach?
Wait, I was just wondering what you're doing tonight.
Just getting ready to listen to a podcast.
Ooh, you like podcasts? What's your favorite podcast?
Oh, just Percolated Media's Three Men in a Retrospective podcast where they look at various franchises one film at a time.
Really? Is that the one with Garrett, Adam, and Matt?
Yeah, this next month and a half, they'll be looking at the Scream series, where two of them haven't watched past the fourth film of the series.
You never told me your name.
Why do you want to know my name?
Because I want to know who I'm looking at.
Scream 6 released March 10th, 2023. Budget was $35 million. Box office worldwide was $166 million. Wow. And this was directed once again by Matt Bettinelli, Oppen, and Tyler Gillette. Matt, is this the 90s again? We have a year later. Here we are. We had another Scream. Were you surprised at the fact that they released another one pretty quickly afterwards?
That was the most surprising thing of all, was the turnaround time on this. It's almost like they started production immediately after they finished making five. Maybe they were gambling on themselves a bit, but I was shocked this came out a little over a year. No, I was expecting 2 years at minimum, but no, this was back to the Friday the 13th model, where we got to crank one of these out every year.
Yeah, that blew me away. That was quick. Even the Halloween reboot triloquial thing, did like a year and a half, 2 years in between each one of the Halloween kills and ends. So this was, you know what? Strike while the iron's hot. Good for them.
Yeah, and it should be said too, and we mentioned this last week, but last week's film was done during COVID. They had ideas for another one, and as soon as this one was seen as being a success, they already had this idea pretty much in mind, so they went pretty quick with this. All right, let's talk about the cast. We got Melissa Barrera back. We have Jenna Ortega back. At this point, she'd already had a hit with Wednesday. She probably was able to negotiate a few more zeros on that contract. Courteney Cox said, okay. And then the idea came to bring Neve Campbell on. And if I knew anything about this movie, and Adam, you touched on this last week, it was the struggle of salary of Neve Campbell being brought back and her saying that as a part of this series, she felt insulted by the offer they laid on the table. And she said no.
It's hard to see Scream without Neve Campbell. On the other side, good for her for standing up for herself. And on a third, good for her for the industry. I mean, the only reason it was news is because she's a woman and because, women are problematic for standing up for themselves, which is such bullshit. So good for her. And of course, everybody who also signed contracts for the film then came out and was like, yeah, we support her too while we're spending Paramount's money. But good. I'm glad that she had the forethought to say, nah, I deserve better than this. And I'm proud of somebody I don't know, but I think it's important for voices to stand up.
Now, were you thinking that was going to be a ding on any of the quality of this film, given the fact that she wasn't coming back?
No, because I assumed after what little I knew that it was a perfunctory offer and was probably designed to get her to say no. So I didn't think they actually had a plan with her. I think they wanted to know.
Now, Matt, as the person who has been probably most critical of Neve Campbell this entire series, what did you feel when you heard that she wasn't coming back for this?
Well, I thought the circumstances were pretty shitty and just goes to show how terrible it is to be a woman and not be paid what you deserve. And quite frankly, I felt like if that was the rationale they were going to take, and good on her for sticking up for herself, I would not have brought a single person back and just made this entirely about the new cast, because you had a foundation to build on. And I feel like Scream 5, part of the appeal of that was getting the returning characters back to kind of add legitimacy in the same way that, Star Wars tried and all these other franchises that have done it. But now you had the runway to leave them behind and forge your own path. So I was kind of disappointed when I heard Courteney Cox was going to be in it, but Neve Campbell was not. To me, it was all or nothing, and I wish they didn't bring anybody back. That was my rationale, outside of the directors.
Here's the thing. I think storyline wise, I say good riddance because it felt like a struggle to write her into each and every movie after the second one, right? And she didn't seem like she wanted to be back for the majority of these. We talked about with three, you know, she only gave them 20 days because she was working on other things. Last week, she had to be given a very nicely worded letter by the directors to convince her to come back. Scream 4, it was because her career was kind of on a downturn and she was game for that one. But I think from a Hollywood standpoint, because I remember when all this was going down, I am right with you guys. And the struggle that she's had to go through as far as a successful woman in this industry is a lot. And especially the years following the Weinstein debacle and all that. I applaud her for standing up for what she believes in. But I'm with Matt in the fact that if you don't have her here, then let's do something else. And when I heard Courtney Cox is back, and by the way, Courtney Cox is on as a producer in this too. I don't know if you guys caught that.
Yeah, she's an executive producer.
She's an executive producer on this. So maybe she had a little bit more at stake than normal, but I did not bat an eye when I came into this. The only thing that made me stand back was the fact that, and I mentioned this at the end of last week's podcast, I had heard last week's movie was a great way of re-upping the franchise, and I did not really like that film. Coming into this, I was not looking forward to watching this. Matt, a year later, you're in theaters for this?
Yeah, I was excited for this immensely because I liked the last one the most out of all of us. This one to me seemed like, okay, they did the last one as sort of a, they put their own voice on it, but they were still like, okay, maybe there were some studio mandates to get this back off the ground. And going into this one, I felt like they had full carte blanche to do their own thing. And maybe they'd have 100% ownership rather than the majority, but not the entirety.
Adam, I did not ask you this at the end of last week's podcast. What did your daughter think of last week's film?
She likes it quite a bit, though she is not a fan of Jenna Ortega, amazingly enough. Wow. Like but that generation feels that she's a fake goth, to quote, and I've heard that more than once. But she thought it was a good way to go because that feels more her than the other ones.
All right. Well, given the fact that we have no Neve Campbell here, and you were kind of high on last week's film, you gave it a 7. How'd you feel coming into Scream 6?
If you would have asked me before I saw it, I wouldn't have cared. And clearly I didn't because I didn't go see the film. After watching 5, I was ready to go right into 6 because knowing that we were getting the same team writing and directing, and I thought 5 did a good job of getting me excited again, I was ready to go. I knew I was going to be disappointed missing Neve, but I did think that they set this team up for the way to go forward. And I agree with both of you that if you're missing Neve Campbell, don't have Cox back. Just don't do it. But yeah, I was completely ready to go, and I felt like they were, now they did not have their hands tied with what came before, that they would be allowed to do their own movie.
Okay, so we open up, we have the Paramount and Spyglass logos, along with Samara Weaving, fresh from Ready or Not, answering a call at a restaurant after receiving some texts. Now, these two did say they wanted to bring her into this series after how much they enjoyed working with her on Ready or Not. It took me a double take. I honestly thought this was Margot Robbie at first.
Yeah, you and every other straight man in America.
I'm telling you, I could not get past it. But she's here. She's doing her full accent. I like seeing her here. She's in this yellow garb that was worn by Gail in the first film, I believe. The weird thing about this is we think she's the first kill, but she's actually not.
She's the first on-screen kill.
Yeah.
But outside of that, yeah, this is... I mean, this opening, much like the first one, it's the last one, not the first one, is a subversive take on the formula of these movies. But I also like the yellow dress is very distinctive. I like that she's designed to stand out, especially against, as we'll find out, a red building. I was kind of not excited per se, but this was the first indicator to me that they perhaps had a lot more say in the casting of this movie. You know, bringing her back as a collaborator. I mean, they would also work with Melissa Barrera on Abigail after, we'll talk about it next week, but I like that now they're like, all right, let's bring in some people that we past collaborators.
I was so happy right off the bat. One, freaking Miss Weaving will, to me, always be just that step above Margot Robbie. But then again, I've not seen Wolf of Wall Street, so nudity be damned. This made me happy. I don't know what it was about it, but she can act. She's got presence. She captivates the second she's on screen. And much like Drew Barrymore in that first one, I was just raptured right away. And I agree, the way that it's shot, the colors. I mean, she might as well be, you know, the woman in the red dress from The Matrix, because woman in the yellow dress here stands out. Good call. It's clear we're getting something a little different. We're getting the familiar opening, but they're changing it. I like this a bunch.
So she's told by the person she's meeting at the bar that they're lost as she gets a call from Reggie. Weaving, with her full accent, goes back and forth with Reggie, who's not on Hudson, and he starts stammering after the terrible first impression he's been making. She's asked what her favorite scary movie is, and she starts going on about the tropes of scary movies at the time, which includes answering the phone, and Reggie says that he's more of a rom-com guy. He's told the outside of the restaurant is red, and she goes outside to verify. He says that he's found an alley to cut through, and he says that he's coming down the alley. He says that there's some dumpsters halfway down, and they both can't find each other. Reggie calls out that this is creepy, as he asks her to wave, and she does. She's told the person waving isn't her, and he's being followed. He says that the person's after him, and the worst part is she teaches a class about slashers, and she just walked down an alley alone. I thought this was very clever. I like this opening a lot.
This is great. I was sitting there going, oh, this might be on its way to rivaling the first one as far as having the best opening of the series. Because I also like that they move outside to a couple of different directions. And unlike a lot of movies, you know, this was shot in Vancouver.
Yes.
It does feel like a New York movie, though.
Yeah, unlike the aforementioned Jason Takes
Manhattan. Yeah, unlike Jason Takes Manhattan and a lot of these other ones, this does feel like you're in the heart of New York City when it's called upon.
Although, are there alleys in New York?
Oh, yes.
Oh, there are? Okay.
I've passed out in a few.
I enjoyed this so much. I like the way that it's shot. I like the tension that it builds. And it's just got a sense of something a little different. I don't think any of us gave any of them a bad mark as we've gone, but they've been varying levels. But you're at 6. Change it up a little bit. And I think they do a good job here starting off changing it up while feeling familiar and having a really good actress to help sell this. Because you could have went with whoever the face of the day was. You know, Samara Weaving, as great as she is, isn't somebody that's on the cover of Teen Beat. God, is that even out anymore? God, I just aged myself. You know, she's not that kitschy face that you get. So I'm glad they got an actress that sells this because it helps the movie start off on the right foot.
Adam, she's not calling you back.
You don't know that. Ready or not, here I come.
We see her gutted as she screams, and here come the stabs, fast and heavy, as he raises the note again, and he says that, now I see something red, as he pulls the knife down. He then unmasks, and it's someone we haven't seen before. This is the guy from, it took me a beat to get this, but I looked it up, it's true. This is the same guy from Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yep.
It's the same kid.
Yep, and you could say he killed her in a flash.
Good one. He takes the outfit off and changes before grabbing his backpack and leaving the scene of the crime. I like this opening kill quite a bit. I'm already on board with this.
This unmasking completely threw me off, though,
because
I think they're changing the rules for a Scream movie at this point, that they abandoned the whodunit. They did a good job of throwing me off.
Gotta change it up, and I agree with this. As he's walking, he runs into Tara, and we hear that his name is Jason, because of course it is. Jason says that he might go to the party later, as he asks if her sister is coming. Tara says that she'll save a drink for him as he walks in the door of his apartment. He's calling for Greg as he puts the mask, one of many, on a mannequin head. His phone rings and he answers, saying that he got massive blue balls and chickened out. He's getting the voice on the other line, who claims that it's Greg trying to master the voice. Jason tries begging Greg to go to the party as Tara's going to be there, and he starts describing the kill that he just did. Jason says that his teacher was just meat and fuck her as he downs a shot. He says he's mad that he got a C- on his Jalo paper. And Matt, I don't know if you do get even a C- on a Jalo paper with how much you don't like Jalo.
Well, if it's well written, I will give credit to any any paper as long as it's objectively good.
What if Matt with the Jalo shot there?
Greg tells Jason. Nice. Greg tells Jason that they've known each other 8 years and they are finishing Reggie's film. Greg tells him to play a game, and he's saying that he's very cold as he walks around the apartment. Jason says that he's going to hang up as Greg says he's getting warmer. And as he turns around, he goes to the refrigerator and sees Greg as another ghost face appears behind him and stabs him multiple times as he yells, "Who gives a fuck about movies?" And the title card shows up. Great opening title sequence. I like this a lot.
Oh, I was shocked also that this one is probably the most, probably the goriest by far. And the most outlandish with the kills. Like seeing a mangled body in a fridge is something that I did not think I would see in a Scream movie, but I thought this opening was between seeing the killer unmask in an opening and this. I thought this whole movie was going to be about, like, between that and the location change, completely traversing all the rules and doing its own thing.
Yeah, I mean, this took me to Friday the 13th Part 2. I think that was the last time I saw a head in a fridge. So
not since Stephen King's It.
Yeah.
I think it's fantastic. I think this opening completely, it puts me off balance, and that's what it should do. I love that they completely reinterpreted the fridging joke or comment or commentary. Like, they literally use fridging here, and they use it in a way for his partner. That is just great. I like that the mask looks different. But even to Matt's point, that it's a different voice being Ghostface at the beginning, and they kind of call that out here, you know, with different voice. So this is smart, and it's still brutal and vicious. That I can't believe that I was just like, yeah, this. It's taken six films to get this far, and good job.
I'm not going to go as far as Matt and say this is up there with Drew in the first film, but I'm going to say it's second best. So we cut to Manhattan, which Jason isn't in anymore.
You don't know that. That boy is still down there.
As Sam hears the sirens, and we see that she's in therapy. She says that she's worried about Tara, and her therapist says that he's worried about Sam. He says every time he pushes her for specifics about her father, she pushes him away. And she says that she just has trust issues. But after some pushing, she reveals who her father was, and that last year she found out that her boyfriend was a killer as well. Good reintroduction, Sam. I like this.
Yeah, and it's an impossible mission to gain trust from Kittredge.
Yes, I got that too. Crazy seeing him here.
Worst therapist, though.
Yes.
You don't know who her father is. Bullshit.
I know.
So that believability. Therapy, blah, blah, blah. We all need therapy. Fine. Sorry, this is a home discussion.
She starts scrolling a bit as she swears that she didn't do any of the killing until she had to stab Richie 22 times and then slash him in the throat. She then says that she's here because it felt right. Well, no shit. If you're fucking slicing the throat after stabbing him that many times. Her therapist says that he's not equipped to deal with this, and he just needs to alert the authorities. She says, forget it. You're just like all the others, and then leaves. We cut to her walking the streets as she calls Tara, and she says that she'll cook dinner tonight if she wants. Sorry, we see Sam in the apartment and lock it multiple times before calling for Tara. She gets no answer as she finds that Quinn, who's fucking Paul a little too loud. She says that life is all about variety. I know this chick from a movie from a few years ago. She was in a really underrated horror film called Totally Killer, which I recommend people check out. It's on Amazon. I knew right away who this was. Now, I didn't pin that she'd end up being a killer, but I like seeing her here.
And anyone who's lived with roommates, especially in college, has lived this on one side or the other. Sometimes both.
Yes.
I'm two parts. One, yes, it's funny because the roommate part, you absolutely, and Jenna Ortega's response is fantastic. But on the other side, I'm disappointed that this is modern horror. You can hear sex, but you are never going to see nudity anymore in a modern horror film. In the old days, you would have shown a sex scene. You're not getting that anymore.
Well, the comedy is about the sounds that they make, but you wanted to see the inside as well, huh?
I didn't want anything. Okay. He did.
All right.
No, it's just that you don't like that. Titties used to be a part of horror. And for something that deconstructs it that way, it's the type of thing that you realize isn't there until they're making a joke about sex sounds and not sex.
Quinn tells Sam that Tara went to the Omega Kappa Beta party, and Quinn also says that she can't speak to how armed Tara is. Sam spots cute boy shirtless from across the street, as he's called, and she refuses to talk to him, or so she says. We then cut to the party as we have gaggles and gaggles of beer swillers here. Mindy says that it doesn't bother her that she's at a house party when her friends were murdered at a house party. I like seeing Mindy back. You know, even if I didn't agree with the angle that they took her character in the last film, I liked seeing her here.
Yes, and I think they're given a little bit more freedom to stand out since they're not having to fight for screen time as much as they did in the previous movie because the legacy characters and the friend group was much bigger. I think this one's a little bit more focused.
I agree with that. Now, did you have a problem with the fact that they have gone from Woodsboro to Manhattan and they're all like still together after all this time?
No, that really doesn't bother me. My only question is just why New York? Like, they could have said like Tara was on scholarship or Sam got a really good job, neither of which are the case. So it just felt like, okay, we only picked New York because it's something different.
Yeah. What I like Mindy a lot more in this film, and specifically Matt Cut, she's given much more to do. Same. And it shows that Jasmine Brown finally gets to play here. The other ones, they're various level of okay. And some of the new ones are various level of okay. Like Quint, I can't stand her from the beginning to the end. So it's a little all over the place of how I feel about the characters. As a way of like, you got the party scene. Cool, you got it out of the way early. But four or five friends from one town are not going to the same college on the other side of the country.
So you bumped up against it then?
Only because I have a senior. So I'm dealing with, oh my God, I have two friends going to this school, but all the other ones are going to separate school. It's a part of what I'm going through. Just because they're all in college together. Mm. It's just a little off.
But
it's also the thing of this is the, if we're looking at this as stab two, this mm-hmm. is screen two as far as being in college.
Yeah.
Correct. Yep. Good point. And I would also argue that I think that the trauma involved with what happened in last week's film is what brought them all together. And they kind of call that out later. You know, they give themselves a little mm-hmm. nickname later. So in that way, I think it's actually written better.
Oh, yeah.
So we see Tara just having a grand old time. She says that she's from Michigan and tells her remaining friends that she's just going to hang. She says she appreciates her friends looking out for her as she sticks around. We didn't see a cowboy and a medieval kid trying to decide whether to ask someone out as Tara is found by Chad, Cuba's kid, making another appearance. A fight breaks out as Sam shows up and hits a dude with a stun gun. This pisses Tara off and she storms out. She says it's her decision whether she wants to go to the counselor or not, and that she won't let that 3 days define her entire life. I like this scene a lot. I like the fact that we're establishing that, you know, Sam's going to therapy, trying to deal with what happened, and Tara's just trying to drink it off.
Yeah, I like that it's showing that not everyone handles trauma the same way, but they're also, neither one is vilified for their choice of how they process it. And I think it would have been very easy to make Tara just the unlikable younger sister. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel like they go down that road.
Yeah, it would be easy to have her be unlikable as younger sister, older sister. It takes away the demonization of sex that we've gotten in other films on this. I feel like it's much more sex positive than every woman is a whore and deserves to be killed for it. So I appreciate the way that this stuff is written. The risky business, you know, nod is funny, but I don't believe in trigger warnings, but I want one before I see a stun gun to the balls, because Jesus Christ. Oof.
You know, I don't think since the third one, when we had Sydney not really trust anybody, and then at the final shot, we see her leaving the door open. You know, we haven't really had an arc like this, and I kind of like that they went for it.
Yeah, this is one of the better continuations of characterization mm-hmm. from one film to the next.
So we hear that Sam is working two jobs, and Tara says that she's going to get her college degree and start living her life, as Sam says that she's just looking out for her. Tara says she needs to let it go, as Sam is doused and called murderer. So this is going to be played up later on, where she kind of yells at these people who come to her and calling her murderer, and she's going to rebel against it. I don't know too much about Melissa Barrera. We're going to talk about her next week a lot. I do know that she kind of took a beating in last week's movie, right, Matt? Where not just in the film, but in the press and the toxic fandom that kind of went down on her. So is this a response to that?
See, I don't know, because I don't remember that happening from my perch. If it did, maybe that's being reflected. But it's also the thing of, like, much like the last one, this film has something to say about fandom and perception and how the truth can be manipulated very easily on the internet, and people get up in a frenzy about it just because they read something and want to join, like, the mob mentality mm-hmm. and not do the actual research.
Yeah, I knew about it vaguely, and some of those I know about it, and that's all.
Okay. Sam's given some tissues to help clean the mess as Tara uses that damn inhaler from last week. And this was an idea of Jenna Ortega, because apparently they didn't write the inhaler for this film. So she's just like, wait a second, don't I have asthma? So the directors were like, okay, that's right. Yeah, go ahead and use it.
Yeah, because we ended up not caring about it by the end of last film. So let's not care about it again.
Quinn apologizes to Tara for telling Sam where she was, as we hear that Quinn lost her brother and her mom transferred to the NYPD. Chad shows up looking for some shots as Tara thanks him for not letting her go up the stairs earlier. He says that survivors got to stick together and that he thinks she's really special. So we get a love connection here. I was not expecting a love story in this. Another thing I wasn't expecting in Scream 6.
He's such a Chad.
Well, one of the characters literally calls that out at yes. the end of the movie.
Yes, and I could have applauded at that moment. We need to start thinning some of these out. I don't need everybody from last film to be in all of this film. I'm starting to resent that they're all around.
Well, you won't be resenting too long. They lean to kiss as Quinn shows up to cock block them while looking for her phone. Chad tells Tara not to be too hard on her sister, as she loves her very much, as Tara lays down with a smile on her face.
I gotta say, I like that in a moment, this thing is better written than, as much as you like the twists and all that, the writing is better than we've gotten in the other ones. And even the, please stop saying cock, stop saying cock. Like, it breaks for comedy and gives you a breath when you have to, and I appreciate that.
for the record, with Cox, it should be show, not don't tell.
We cut to Sam kissing Danny, as he's named. This is the guy from across the street, and she stops, afraid that someone might see them. She says that she's not ready for another relationship after the events that happened to her. So what, this is just a wham, bam, thank you, sir? Like,
it's like testing the waters.
Yeah. She says that being famous isn't all it's cracked up to be, and that Tara's mad at her. Sam's then summoned upstairs, and we're hearing about the crimes that happened the night before, as Jason Carvey was obsessed with Argento, unlike Matt. Jason Carvey, you know, I understand that they're going for the whole thing. You know, he uses knives, you know, Jason Carvey. But Adam, am I the only one who thought of the brother from Wonder Years? Jason Harvey?
No, I can't not. Yeah. God, that's a, I know. That's a deeper cut than Scream 3.
Sam grabs a knife and says this isn't a coincidence, as Tara knew the person murdered and they need to get out of the city. Quinn calls her dad as the phone rings, and Sam sees that it's Gail Weathers, and the other kids wonder why people freak every time a phone rings. Another nice call out. I like that. We then meet Detective Bailey, Dermot Mulroney, and I was not expecting to see him here. Adam, did this shock you as much as it shocked me?
I'm so glad I didn't look at any cast list for this movie. This blew me away. What a pull.
And, you know, he was in a movie, and Adam, I think you and I saw it together. He was in Copycat. And I think they might be playing off that. Not a good movie. It's from like the mid-90s. Not a very good movie.
I disagree. I'm a big fan of that one.
Yeah. We've always had that fight.
I would be.
The guy who loves Sigourney Weaver doesn't even like that movie.
I know. Exactly. I think they might be playing off that.
I think they're playing off that, but I also think they're playing off Mark from the earlier film.
Oh, good call.
I remembered his name this time.
You did. Matt, were you expecting Dermot Mulroney here?
No, but I knew he was the killer instantly because I read the words Dermot Mulroney in the cast list. Like, one of these things is not like the other.
You knew this right away, huh?
Yeah, and it's just him. Like, first of all, change your goddamn name. I'm already getting him confused with Dylan McDermott.
Yes. All
the goddamn time.
Thank you.
It's bad enough that they both mostly play douchebags. And in this, I thought it was very clear he was one of the villains. Like, I think of all the ones, you know, I talk about, it's the destination, the journey, not necessarily the destination. This one, I knew it as soon as I put into my GPS.
You know what? I wasn't buying into that until we see him use a shotgun later. And then I was like, okay, only a fucking police detective would use it like that.
Well, I call it also because this came out at a time where police were not being portrayed in the best of light. Good and that point. Was a very contentious issue. I think that was a very clear social statement to make a cop one of the villains.
Good point. So Detective Bailey says that Sam needs to come to the station as her phone rings again, and it's coming from Richie's number, which, funny little cameo from Jack Quaid here.
He's got a couple of them in this.
Yeah, yeah. They said he was more than happy to come do these facial shots and whatnot that they use in this film. She answers it, and we hear, "Hello, Samantha." Doesn't have the same ring as "Hello, Sydney," does it, Adam?
Not a bit.
Well, it's too many syllables. It's one extra syllable.
Yeah, exactly. She says the last two who did this ended up dead. He also says that he knew that Jason and Greg were going to kill the two of them, and he gutted them before they had a chance. He says he's not protecting them, but he's going to show the world what a liar she is, as well as a killer, and that he's going to punish her. He says that he's not going to stop.
I'm going to break you, Batman.
He says he's not going to stop until he guts them, and she better watch her back. And this is when Ghostface attacks. They walk into a convenience store, and Ghostface guts the first guy to approach him. He gets shot at by the shop owner, and as he grabs for his keys, Ghostface attacks him. And I know this caused quite a stir. Adam, you brought this up in the beginning of this podcast, and I kind of kept quiet, and I'm going to bring it up right now. I like the idea of Ghostface having a shotgun, especially in New York. I think this is what would happen.
I have no problem with it. People threw a fit because of they see things in a trailer, and they don't have fucking context. He didn't bring a shotgun to this. Store owner had it. He took it away. He used it. I got no problem with this. I think it works for the scene. And I think this bodega battle, for lack of a better word, is shot really well. Is also, like, this movie's shot pretty dang good. Nah, this works well for me. But people, you know what? Stop getting pissed at trailers. Wait for the movie.
Okay, I misread you, because I know you said at the beginning that you saw him using a shotgun, and I thought you said in a divisive tone, but you actually like that.
Yeah, I think it works.
Okay.
Yeah, it was, a lot of people were upset, saying, like, that's not Scream. It was like Matthew Lillard, of all people, was very against
it. Yeah, he was vocal against this film. As was David Arquette. I think David Arquette said it was too violent, yeah, too.
There are a lot of people who were kind of against it, but I'm like, you know, if you're a serial killer, it doesn't matter what weapon you use. Murder is murder, no matter how it's executed, no pun intended. I also like what they use with the sound design in this. With them walking on the glass and the sound just cuts. There's like no music. I think this is a very well done scene. And you kind of had to do these smaller type of scenes in a city as big of New York to establish some stakes.
Agreed. Now, Matt, I didn't bring this up when you mentioned you went to theaters to see this, but I need to mention that this was the first Scream movie released in 3D. I'm seeing a lot of dark scenes here. I'm seeing, like, I don't know how 3D would pop in a film like this. Did you see this in 3D? I'm guessing not, because you hate 3D.
No, and I would have sworn they would have done the fourth one in 3D, because that came out during the post-Avatar crisis.
Yeah, I mentioned that during that podcast, but I don't know. I think the one scene that would work for this is when they're on the roof later, but that's literally the only place I could see 3D actually working in this film, because everything's so goddamn dark. So Ghostface is walking around the shop, shooting at the shelves, and Sam and Tara, they remain on the ground, and Sam throws a can to distract him. They try crawling out, but the sound of broken glass, as you mentioned, Matt, stops them dead in their tracks. Sam tips the shelf, and they exit the shop. Again, I like the scene.
Yeah, it's not just a perfunctory scene. It does a good job. It's a change up from what we've seen, and it feels right.
They see the mask on the ground as we cut to the girls being approached by Bailey. He says that DNA on the mask found at the apartment belongs to Richie Kirsch, killer from the last film. He then asks if they have alibis, and Tara says that they were with people all night.
This points the feelings I had at the end of the last film. They name drop Richie like 7 times in this film.
Mm-hmm.
I had to stop and look up who Richie was. Because I didn't remember.
It's been a week.
Who Richie was. I know.
Bailey said that someone attacked them and stole their license and put it close to the body. They would need to be close to them. Bailey then vouches for his daughter, Quinn, and Tara says that she doesn't want to point the finger at anyone still alive. And this is, man, Matt, I was telling Adam before you got on the call that I was so glad you kept this quiet, because I had a big smile on my face when that chair turns and we have good old Kirby Hayden Panettiere back on the scene. This was great. I like seeing her.
This one was publicized and I wish it wasn't.
See, I had no idea. Wow, marketing did not work on me, because I had no idea about this. Matt, did you like seeing her here?
Yeah, I like seeing her back. I think it's a little coincidental that she became an FBI agent of all things.
Yes.
But I guess for context, it's fine.
You're going to bring somebody back. The only issue I have is you're bringing back her and leaving out Sydney, but... yeah, I popped when this happened. I was surprised. I'm glad I didn't know ahead of time. And even though we got, you know, Hicks last time, sure, bringing her back as a cop as well. It feels a little redundant. I don't care. This is kind of a cool swerve.
I mean, when I was looking for images to attach to this podcast, I did see that she's on the poster. So it's like, I'm glad I didn't look at anything.
She's on the poster, but if you're not keeping up with Hayden Panettiere, you don't know that's her on the poster.
And I guess there was a huge debate as to how her hair is going to look, because she had that pixie cut in the last film and they couldn't decide on what to have her hair as in this. And she's the one who said, yeah, just have it long and flowing. I'd be different than I was 13 years ago.
Give her bangs, right, Gail?
She's here. She's showing them the scar that Charlie Walker gave her. And she says that she takes a special interest in these types of cases. Boy, that was not a good idea in hindsight, was it, Adam?
No, whatsoever.
Given what happens to her later. Kirby says that Tara is the last in a long line of escaped victims. We didn't see the entrance of producer Courtney Cox here as Gail Weathers, who avoids the punch of Sam but can't avoid Tara's. So we're bringing the fact this chick's jaw must be dislodged with how many times she gets punched in the series.
Well, you think with the amount of Botox, it would harden up like a rock. Like it'd be impenetrable. Okay. There was no reason for Gail to be in this movie.
Except for what happens to her. That's the only reason you bring her.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But on the surface level, I like the scene they do with her later on. But this movie could function entirely without her conclusion from a narrative standpoint. And again, it's sort of we talked about this with some franchises. It's always like she gets reset every other movie. Like she has growth and then she's back to what she was in the first movie.
Agree with all that. And it just popped into my head. They could have had her be an opening scene kill.
Oh, people Absolutely. Would have rioted. People would have lost their minds. If you thought the fandom was mad with Star Wars, holy crap.
I mean, but imagine opening a film killing off Gail and actually having it stick.
Well, I like the opening we got, so I'm not going to I'm not going to say that, but no, that would have had
the
impact.
Bad part is we got an amazing opening. I just think that would be a nice. I just think that'd be a nice way for the series to go. It's nice to see her back. The duck and Bob out of the blow, just to then get caught anyway. It's, you know, little things like that made me laugh watching all these. Again, I said if you didn't bring back one, you shouldn't have brought back any. But I do think she served pretty well in this film.
Sam is upset that Gail wrote a book on her plot from the last film after saying that she was going to write about Dewey. I think Gail got like maybe two chapters into that and was like, you know what, this would be a boring book. I'm just going to write about what happened.
My lawyer says I can't talk about my ex-husband.
Yeah. Gail responds that somebody was going to do it, as true crime is all the rage now. And she goes on to say that she spoke to Sydney. She's living the life with her husband, Kincaid, and their kids, and she sends her love. Boy, here's a way to write Sydney out.
Oh, it's such a, like, I know they had to do it, but, oh, God. It's...
Yeah, my eyes rolled at this.
I'm glad she gets acknowledged, though, and they say, look, she's happy, she's content. I'm glad they didn't just ignore her completely.
But my problem is they say she went into hide.
Yeah.
That's my problem.
That did upset me, because they were like, is she coming back? No.
Gail says that she deserves to have her happy ending. And we're seeing Sam's therapist watching TV, screaming, "You're next," as there's a knock on his door. He asks who it is, as he says that they're a day early for trick-or-treating, and he ends up with a knife in the dome. Again, these guys just, they love having these scenes of these knives in the face. But this was a good way to go, I guess.
You'd think after all those Mission Impossible movies, he learned not to use his eye to, like, use it like a retinal scanner.
Right.
I thought it was a pretty effective, brutal kill. At the end of the day, I don't understand why.
Because he has information in the files that he was to use against Sam. That's why.
Well, clearly he doesn't lock him up and he completely violates HIPAA, them unsecured at home. I know it's not a HIPAA violation, people. But other than a kill just to kill, look, it's an effective kill. But this therapist, he's a plot device.
Ghostface comes in and starts stealing some files as we cut back to the school and that song from the first film plays. We see Mindy talk about someone making a sequel to the requel. As in the first one, the victims were in high school, and in this one, the victims are in college. At this point, I hate the rule scene. It just feels like an obligation to do, and Matt, you go with that, right?
Yeah, but only because I have no other choice.
Mm-hmm.
This time it bugs me a little bit because you're even staging this one like what we had before with them sitting in the courtyard. So I understand you got to do it, but then you lay them out to say, but you got to contradict them by doing this, this, and this. It goes on too long. Longest movie in the franchise. There's 20 minutes to cut out of this film, and this, you can't eliminate this scene, but damn, trim it down.
Yeah, 2 hours, 3 minutes, and man.
No horror movie should be over 50 at the longest.
No.
As the guy who loves New Nightmare.
That was about an hour 50.
It's about an hour and 49 minutes.
God, we need to do that series.
Nope, just that one.
All right, let's go over the rules. So rule number one of franchises is that everything is bigger, which you have to do in order to bring everyone back to the cinema.
Well, almost everybody.
Almost everybody. Except for two on this podcast. Rule number two, whatever happened last time, expect the opposite. Fuck, man. What's up with this shot at Letterboxd users? Fuck you.
I thought of you so much.
And rule number three, no one is safe, as even legacy characters are brought back for death.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Boy, don't know what happens.
Are they? Shit.
Yeah, I have thoughts when we get to that.
And we're also hearing that franchises are just episodic installments to continue the IP.
Oh, that was the biggest shot at Marvel?
Mm-hmm. I felt like that was a slap to the TV series.
Oh, the Scream TV series? Yeah, maybe.
Yep.
Ethan then asks if he's part of the group and if he'll die a virgin. Did you guys recognize this Ethan character, by the way?
Oh, you mean not Evan Peters? Like, he looks like a clone. When Evan Peters was like young, 20-something, he looks like his long-lost clone. But I know that's the kid from Avatar.
Yeah, he's the non-blue character in Avatar.
Yeah. Jack Champion, Spider. I am the only one that knows those movies, aren't I?
You are, yes. Mindy calls Ethan and Quinn out as being suspects, and we find out that she's a roommate of them because she answered an ad. Mindy then calls out Annika as you can't trust the love interest. Ethan calls out the four from the last film and that there are certain rumors about Tara being bound about out there. We see Bailey mention that Sam's therapist was found stabbed through the eye, and Kirby responds to this by wincing and saying, that's pretty messed up. I loved Kirby being back here. I cannot emphasize that enough. Bailey also says that Sam's files were stolen and that he had turned her in for making threatening remarks, making Sam a suspect. And we hear that Roland Bridger's DNA was on the mask located in this death. Remember Scott Foley from the third film?
Well, I like that she says, oh, at least he had ambition or something.
Yeah. And Bailey asks what happens when they get to one. Kirby goes over all the other killers and who it leaves, which is, of course, Mickey, Nancy, and Billy Loomis and Stu. I guess this scene was a huge stumbling block for them because they had to get the rights of these people to use their pictures. And apparently that was a little bit of a tough get for them to get, like, Laurie Metcalf and them to say yes. Kirby gets a call and leaves as Bailey watches her go and tells his assistant to pick up what they can on Kirby. Tara then tells Chad that she wouldn't blame him if he went, and Chad says that he's not going anywhere, as everyone scoffs. Nice response there. Chad says that there's a slumber party with the Core Four, which no one goes with. They see on the news that Sam is the prime suspect, as video leaks of her going after someone on the street. Tara tells her that someone she knows is not a fan of how she's handling things, and she knows that no one can relate to how they are handling things themselves. So we're getting some plot here, right, Adam?
Yeah, we're getting our third act information. We're getting what we need to know for the end. It's not smooth, but it kind of fits for a Scream film.
I like what Matt brought up earlier, and that this is how everybody handles grief is different. And we're seeing that kind of personified here.
Yeah, it's also the no matter what, someone on the internet will find something to exaggerate, and you'll have that mob mentality just come after you.
Yep. Sam says she knows she shouldn't care about how people think, and it sucks being hated. Again, I think this is a call out to Barrera's haters from the last film. Chad says that no one hates her, and they all moved here for the main reason that they're all a part of the same team. The Core Four, if you will. Sam reveals that she's been sleeping with cute boy from down the hall, so this finally gets out. Speaking of which, we cut to him watching the news as Ghostface walks by in the room next to Sam. Danny panics and tries getting her attention as he calls, and they ignore his call. Was Danny too... He was too obvious a suspect.
The boyfriend, yeah.
There's a rustling of beds as all their phones go off, and they're sent the same pic of Quinn getting strangled. There's a scream as Ghostface emerges and throws Quinn down. He starts strangling Annika and digging the knife into her stomach. Ow. Sam's trapped as Mindy is bleeding, and they see a body in the bathtub. Ghostface just can't get through the door as Danny calls Sam to the window. He sends her a ladder and tells her to hop buildings. Fuck this. My God. He tells her to keep her eyes on him as she crawls across. She struggles on the ladder before getting across. Sam then calls for Annika to join them, and Mindy kisses her as Annika tells Mindy to go first. Ghostface makes his way in as Mindy gets across. Annika says that she can't do it as she goes across the ladder, and Ghostface catches up to the ladder and shakes it. Annika reaches for Sam's hand and just falls face first onto the dumpster and dies. This is the best Scream scene I have seen in quite a while. I dug the suspense of it, and just the result, again, is something that we haven't seen, which this movie has done a great job of doing. The character not just falling, but falling onto the dumpster, ow.
Well, I appreciate that this franchise kind of, the first one is much more of a straightforward, like, horror movie than the others. This one I appreciate is putting the suspense as close to the forefront as the humor and the meta, and I think it does it the most effectively since the first one.
You like this death, then?
Oh, absolutely. I like big suspenseful set pieces in this movie, like this, the convenience store attack. I like how these are done.
I think that death is brutally fantastic. This scene takes forever, though, to finally get, you know, get to the end of it. I mean, there's one little room, and it feels like for 5 minutes, Ghostface is just like slamming against the door. So I just wish it was moving along a little bit. But once we get to the ladder, that leap of faith Indiana Jones moment, like this is that tension ratchets up and you're edge of my seat because I know someone's going to fall, but I don't know who and I don't know how bad it's going to be. And oh, shit. Yeah.
I don't know, man. With my sound system, every single time he brushes against that door and he tries getting in, my knuckles were kind of turning white. Every single time he does that and we're hearing the dressers move and everything, like, I don't know. I dug the suspense of this. I like the way they draw this out. So Sam tells Danny that someone took their knives so that they couldn't fight back, so she can't trust anyone. Chad interrogates Ethan, who says that he was in study hall last night. Mindy tells Ethan to step back as he's on top of her list, and Ethan once again says that he had econ.
This is where I do have, I've brought it up before, I'm going to bring it up again. We suddenly cut to the next day.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We are in, it's nighttime, somebody just fell to their death, bleeding out. Ghostface is right over there. You got people killed. You got somebody in a bathtub. Quentin dead, slashed in a bathtub. And suddenly it's just like next day, sunny, and we're all talking. There's a 6 to 10 hour time gap that is unexplained because we're in a horror movie and we can never figure that out.
But do you want this movie to be longer?
No, but
no, you just set this scene immediately after at night.
I just cannot stand that. Did nobody call the cops from that room? Did nobody run to the woman in the... It bugs me. It's just always going to.
Yeah, and this is also where I put together that Quinn and her father were the killers. Because it's the horror rule. No body. No, I don't believe it. And B, I know there's multiple killers in basically every movie. And by singling out Roman with that comment, I know there's going to be multiple in this movie.
Bailey comes in as Tara apologizes for Quinn, and Bailey just can't believe that his kids are gone. He says that they took him off the case, but he's staying on because you fuck with his family, you die.
Yeah, these last two movies have basically become Fast and Furious with the amount of family talk.
Gail once again approaches and says that her motives are genuine, and then Tara apologizes for punching her, to which Gail responds, "No, you're not." Gail tells Bailey that she knows where the masks are coming from, and Bailey tells her to show him, as Gail and Kirby have a mini reunion. Gail's funny here. She says that she's a child. How is she in the FBI? And Kirby says, "I have a gun, Gail." Fun stuff here. I like this. Gail asks how Kirby didn't find this hiding spot, pointing the finger at Kirby. At this point, they really want us to think that Kirby's the killer, don't they?
I don't think they've done clearly the red herrings as they have in the other movies, but they're starting to ramp it up a little bit. And I think she's a good one to point at, but having two different sets of cops in the same movie, yeah, it's a different, I don't know if I dig that completely, but I do believe she's a good possibility. So I'm okay with it, especially because she disappeared completely for two films just to come back.
Right. And you also had the fact, how did she get, you can put her as a mass, as a culprit, because she's one of the few people who could get access to all of the shrine stuff from multiple crime scenes, given she's a federal agent. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good red herring to throw. And also, if you're looking at the logic, legacy characters, like, if they don't die, oftentimes they're brought back to be villains, which we've seen mm-hmm. before. So that's something that would not be out of the realm of possibility.
And I do know that if she's one of them, there's got to be somebody else. The issue that I have is they show her walking with everybody else. And Hayden Panettiere is about an inch taller than your fiance, Garrett. Like, she's 5'1", yeah, maybe, in heels. So
I do like these two together, as Gail tells Kirby that she's good at her job and that she'll get there one day. Just good stuff. They go into the warehouse with X-Files flashlights shining as Gail points out that it's a shrine, and we see all the collectibles that have been collected. And Mindy says that this is the whole goddamn franchise, as we have duct tape, stab books, the knife that Kirby was stabbed with, and Bailey says that all of them have been through so much, as Gail stops at the Dewey section and kind of has a moment. Gail says that cops like money and evidence can get lost pretty easily, present company excluded. And Chad says that Ethan is here so that he can keep an eye on him, as Sam sees the cloak that Billy used. So everybody's triggers are brought up here. Adam, how'd you feel about this reveal?
I think this is a good set piece that somebody had designed and tried to find a way to work it into a film. Anybody that knows real estate knows that there's no way that this place goes unrented by somebody else, yeah. I mean, especially in downtown Manhattan. But I dig it. When you go in and it's set up, I'm glad it's a theater. This is cool. It's a cool set piece. How it fits into this and the logistics, I can't think about that or I'm going to start to not like it. But the setup and the reveal and the staging of it is pretty fucking sweet.
Well, it's also a great, like, tribute to Stab, Scream Stab, same goddamn thing at this point. With, you know, Scream 2, the climax takes place in a auditorium. So this, it's a movie theater, which, how has nobody thought of that before?
Yeah.
We had one of these movies start in a movie theater. And I like the circularity of having one be built around a shrine of basically every prop you could think of. I mean, this is also kind of commentary on, like, the obsessive collectors.
Yeah, this made me think of when I went to Ozfest 2003, 2004, Korn was there. And at one of the displays, one of the trailers that they had, it was actually Jonathan Davis's collection of serial killer memorabilia. And you're going through the trailer and you're seeing John Wayne Gacy's freaking clown outfit that he used and a whole bunch of drawings and things. And it just creeped me the fuck out. And I'm looking at this display and I'm like, man, there are people who actually collect this stuff. Like, this is a thing, you know, especially with all the true crime there, as this movie calls out. It's there. And I like that this movie kind of mentions it.
It feels like the type of thing somebody would put together. I mean, they're especially when, you know, last one talked about message boards and Reddit and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So this is, you would see this.
You mentioned that was with Korn?
Well, yeah, Korn was there at Ozfest.
Like, was Scooby-Doo with them? It's a South Park reference for everyone who doesn't get that. Which makes sense because this franchise is basically the adult equivalent of Scooby-Doo.
Good point.
Let's find out who's behind the mask. And not just because Sarah Michelle Gellar was in one of these.
Okay, well, speaking of who's behind the mask, Skeet Ulrich has to collect a paycheck, so here's Billy with his reappearance, asking
Sam... Hey, he needs the money more than anybody.
Asking Sam how cool this is and how much she must be aching to kill with him. Billy and Sam, together. Tara sees Sam putting her hand on the glass and asks what she's doing, as Sam says that she just doesn't know.
So there's also the line... that, you know, we talk a lot about like fan culture and like fan fiction. The whole Stew is not dead theory is mentioned in this by, I think Mindy says it in this scene. And there was part of the thought process in this movie was that Stew was the leader of this like cult of ghost face killers. And that was going to be the reveal in this.
That is that's called Club Adam, everybody. I've been on Team Stew's Not Dead from the beginning.
Yeah, and you're also the person who said, like, you know, Jason Voorhees can melt steel beams in Manhattan. So.
Kirby says that this isn't a normal stab movie, as her and Mindy have a fun conversation about horror films. I like that they call out that the original is the best Nightmare on Elm Street. No, it's not. Everyone knows that's Dream Warriors. There could be an argument for the final chapter in Friday the 13th, but...
And neither of them said Jason lives?
Yeah. Yeah.
You had two chances at it.
Yes. Especially since this is the sixth film. Why not bring that up?
Well, they couldn't say Freddy's dead.
That's true.
You'd be lying to yourself, and no one would say curse on Michael Myers.
No. And I do like that the TV that killed Stu is here, as you mentioned, Matt. Of all things that kill people in this franchise, and we called this out in that first podcast, how the hell is this death just held up?
Well, that was the thing that gave me at least a certain amount of validity to the idea that he survived if he brought that TV.
Yeah.
If someone was going to do that, it would have been the guy who was almost killed by it.
Mm-hmm. And here's something that me and Matt might answer in a future series. They mentioned that Psycho 2 is underrated, which I agree with.
Yeah, but I feel like that's not even like a hipster thing to say.
And then they mentioned...
That's like the people who say that like Dream Warriors is the best Nightmare movie. Like enough people say that to where it's no longer like passe to be on that hill. Now, if you want to argue Psycho 3 and 4, well, tune in a couple of years.
And I don't care about the Candyman series to have an opinion on which one is better, original or requel. Maybe me and Matt will do that series with Mick at another time, but I don't know. This was a fun conversation, though. I did like seeing these Kirby do what we saw her do in the fourth one.
Yeah, because it's Kirby. We forget that, oh, that's right, she's a cute little horror film nerd. To reference that back is a nice moment. And even just naming off horror movies in a movie, horror movie. I'm going to be Leonardo pointing at the screen during this type of scene. That one. Oh, yep, that one. Oh, no. So this is, this movie has good diversions and kind of lowers your guard a little bit. And the lighthearted moments work really, really well.
Well, it's also respectable because this is a new team. They did not create this character.
Yeah.
They had enough wherewithal to remember that as her characterization.
We see Tara using her inhaler as she asks Sam when she gets to be a normal person, as she doesn't want to be a part of some stupid legacy.
And then she winds up in a Beetlejuice.
Kirby says she'll take it, as Sam is expressing regret about how big of a mess she has made Tara's life. And then Gail asks the million-dollar question of where their mother is, and Sam says that she cut Sam off when she told Tara about who their dad was. It would have seemed to have been cut off the film before, as even with Tara in a hospital bed, she didn't come get her, but we mentioned that last week. So at least they mentioned the mom, right?
Yeah, I mean, but it's a little retroactive. The million-dollar question is, Gail, what's wrong with your face? God damn, every time it's distracting.
It is. You know? Yeah.
Like from four on, it almost looks like she looks like Leatherface.
I know. Gale says, fuck her, meaning their mom, and Sam can make her own family, even if it's with one person, and they need to keep going, as Dewey's music plays in the background. Kirby tells Tara that she died for 4 minutes, and when she recovered, she got mad, and she wanted the monsters to be afraid of her, which is why she became an FBI agent. Bailey says that he thinks he has an idea of how to turn the tables on this creep, and Kirby cuts Gale off, saying that she's good at her job, too. Again, I just love these two together.
Especially because she has no legal reason to be there.
Exactly. Sam and Tara separate from the others, and even Tara is like, we should have stayed with the others. Kirby says that she can trace a call in seconds, and even Mindy says that this is broad daylight, which is how their uncle Randy died. They're walking as Bailey is on guard. Sam's phone rings with Richie's number, and he says that she's going to die choking on her own blood, and he's not nearby, he's a step ahead, and that he'll be seeing her.
So one thing I also have to give a compliment to, if I'm looking at this from a rational perspective, the whole like, oh, Richie's number. Well, of course his family would have the cell phone still.
Yep.
So that tracks, no pun intended.
He's at West 96, which, of course, Scream came out in 96. Kind of a reach there, but that's what I caught. And this is where Gale is, and we cut to Gale with her laptop open and talking shit about Kirby being in the Glee Club. I found that funny. She's like, last time I saw her, she was in the fucking Glee Club. Now she's a goddamn agent. Tara and Sam, they take Bailey's car and then turn on the siren as Bailey just yells, you can't steal a cop car.
New York, you can.
Gale gets a call that her boy toy answers. This was weird. Dewey's dead, but she gets this fucking himbo. I don't know. I guess this is a rebound, maybe.
Yeah, clearly they must have been together during the events of Five.
Apparently.
Otherwise, this would be... You know, like I know they were divorced and all that, but it moved on really quick either way.
Exactly. Especially, you know, not even a year after he died.
She was doing really well for herself in this fucking apartment.
No, no shit, right? God, if journalists made this much money, I'd still be in journalism.
Hire some security.
Yeah. Gale gets a call that, well, don't forget she was on TV too, on that Good Morning Blank show.
Yeah, she had her own national show. Yeah. She was like... Hoda Kotb.
Her boyfriend says that it's the killer on the line. He tells Gale that it's strange that they have never spoken. Which, you know what? I'm glad they called out. We have never seen Gale have a conversation with Ghostface, have we, Matt?
No, because she's always been on the side. Because Sydney's always hogged the spotlight, which the movie also calls out.
I like that. I had to look it up, and then I was like, oh, that's right. I'm glad they call it out. It's a cool moment. I also like it much more when she puts him on hold.
Yes. Yeah, we're going to get there. So Ghostface says that his motive isn't that he's trying to stay relevant, and he responds that no one cares about the legacy characters. She says that he's the 10th guy to try this, and it never works out for the guy in the mask. But Ghostface brings up that Dewey was chopped up, and she wasn't there for him at the end, and he says that she won't be around to see the end of the story, as Ghostface then appears and hops a table. Gale fights him off with a frying pan and tries closing him out as he's just relentless. She unlocks her gun and shoots through the door, saying, how's that for nostalgia, fucker? Ghostface says that she missed, and he's in the elevator headed for the ground floor. Maybe he's wounded, maybe he's wearing a bulletproof vest, she just doesn't know. She responds that's why she's going to shoot him in the head as she emerges from her panic room. He continues blabbing away about how she could never be the leading lady, and she said that that just leads to her being the brains and sex appeal. She puts him on hold as Adam calls out and calls back, firing in that direction, but Ghostface comes out and stabs her in the stomach. She continues fighting him off, and they both end up on the floor. She grabs his knife and tries plunging it into him, but he wakes up and gets her down. He sends the knife to her face as she says, fuck you. And then Sam and Tara, they come in and fight him off. So this struggle with Ghostface, this was something that Courtney Cox, apparently she did all of her own stunts in this scene. She was really proud of that fact. I think it's a nice struggle. It's a nice scene. But again, you're bringing her back just to kill her off. That, I don't know.
No, well, she doesn't die. And that's the problem.
Does she not die? Did they say that she lives?
Oh, she survived. She survives.
I did not hear that line. I thought maybe...
Because at the end of the movie, they say she's at the hospital recovering.
Oh, I did not catch that line. My God, I thought this was her death scene.
No, she lives, and she shouldn't have, because...
No.
Should have been.
God damn, this would have been a good way to go out.
That's why... Oh, God, that means that we're going to see her next week.
So this entire scene... What I love that it starts with her himbo getting taken out in the background, fuzzy. That is great, because if you're not paying attention, or if you decide to look away and second screen for a moment, you're going to miss it. But that is really nicely done. I like this. It's tense. Gale deserves this. Ghostface sure deserves this. I like it a lot, but it also lets me know that this isn't whichever male character it's going to be, because when they're fighting over the knife, Gale, as strong as she is, you know, Courtney Cox is waif thin, and I know that at least one of the killers is going to be female. I cannot stand that she lives through this. I'm getting tired of, in both last week and this week's film, that Ghostface wounds more than kills. And I resent anytime it's in a movie, any freaking idiot that has a headshot and that is just like, hey, warning, and then misses the shot. So the end of the scene pisses me off. But I like the scene as it happens. I think it's pretty therapeutic.
Well, it's also annoying because the dialogue is clearly setting up her to die, because they talk about, you know, in another movie, you would have been the killer, that like you couldn't handle Sydney being the star, and now that she's gone, you went crazy. So, and I thought this would have been a fitting end, because she fights back and it's given like a climactic feel. It's got weight to it. And then they pull their punches at the last minute with her surviving. I think that's just, and it's almost at the same point time-wise where they off to Dewey.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're looking at like repetition, it would have made sense to do that, because this movie also establishes legacy characters can die, and they pull their punches with the biggest one in this movie. So you're kind of running counter to your own rule. And this is one of two people in this movie who should be dead based on the number of stabs and how long it takes for them to get medical attention.
You're just throwing me off by saying she lives through this. Oh my God, that's just crazy to me.
And it's, I don't think it was planned. I think there's a number of lines in this movie that are ADR'd and reshot. And I think it becomes pretty obvious.
I think the last scene is clearly a reshoot.
Yep, I do as well. And I think it's when they knew that they were going to, especially after the last one made so much money and that they were going to make money again, it was like, oh, we got to keep the money train going. And Paramount now is, a couple years ago when they started building and growing, changed a little bit. I think there was going to be a finality that they decided wasn't going
to
be.
Especially, I think they kept her alive to hedge their bet of like, in case we can't get Neve Campbell back, we need someone. And I truly believe, like, if Sydney was in this, they would have offed Gale.
I agree.
Agree.
So Gale tells Sam and Tara to let Sydney know that he didn't get her. And then we have Danny show up, and he says that he got there as soon as he could, and Tara asks if he really did. They all lay down together as Sam says maybe he gets to win this time, as he wants to punish her. She says that she'll give herself up to protect them. Tara says that none of them would be alive if it wasn't for Sam, and she needs to let them protect her as they're all a family. Which has
God, she might as well be driving a freaking supercharger.
Tara says that they can use the fact that they're going to keep getting found against them. And she tells Bailey that they want to lure him into a secure location, trap him inside, and execute him. He says he won't only help them, he'll kill the son of a bitch. Of course he will. By the way, Dermot Mulroney, I think he's having the best time on this set. He is relishing his fucking scenes. He almost plays it a little too big.
And when you get to the end of this movie,
yes,
he might as well be gnawing on the curtains next to the screen with the amount of scenery chewing he is doing.
He offers the idea of traveling in public. So they go to the subway en route to the movie theater, and yep, this is what New York traveling is like, right, Matt?
You have no fucking idea. This makes it look like an Uber drive with the amount of comfort compared to how it actually is.
Yeah, when me and Jen come out to see you this year, we'll definitely let you know how this goes. Ethan again approaches Mindy as she tells him to go away, and we cut to the train where Mindy didn't make it. They start losing power on the train, and this reminded me of Predator 2, of all things, guys.
Yep, I was good. Fuck, I had that in my notes.
Go back to last year's shows. Man, we hear that there are 10 stops left as the lights flicker, and there are a large number of masks on this train. I guess the directors had a struggle. They went to the producers, and they're like, look, we want to put all these masks on here. I guess Hellraiser's on this train. They have Ready or Not, the outfit from Ready or Not here. And they thought maybe there's going to be a struggle to get all the rights, but the producers called them like, nope, go crazy, do what you want. So I guess there's a Nightmare on Elm Street character here.
Oh, yeah, this looks like a normal day on my train here in Oakland. I mean, this is... I had a Cardi B concert this weekend. It looked just like this afterwards.
Oh, my God.
Just as much plastic.
But this is, if you're going to have this kind of fun, this is when you do it. You got a train packed full of people. You learn at the beginning, if you pay attention, that it's like right around Halloween. okay, I guess it's just for a reason. So yeah, do this. Like, this was fun. I didn't pause. I kind of want to go back and pause and just look through everything. But yeah, have fun with this kind of stuff.
It's a bit of a tense scene as they approach 79th Street. Sam keeps seeing the mask approach them and then disappear as Mindy sends texts, and Ethan just looks on. One of the ghost faces bumps into Mindy as he gets off the train and says, sorry, and they approach 72nd Street. Sam sees one of the ghost faces approach aggressively and then get off the train, and then more get off, and I was getting kind of claustrophobic just watching this fucking scene. And Adam, you must have just gotten flashbacks, right? Like, this must have been PTSD for you.
I'm safe in my cab. Just please don't bother the train operator. But yeah, this, goddamn, could we get through one series without me having to see a death on a train? We've done a lot of these. This scene is fine. We've had some really good ones. This one, I get what they're getting for, but especially because we, I don't know, saw Jason Takes Manhattan. This one is fine.
So the lights go out as Mindy gets more freaked out, and there's a ghost face just standing and looking. And then the lights come back on as somebody in a prisoner's uniform is standing there. And then there's a ghost face that stabs Mindy in the gut and takes her down. He continues looking at her as he gets off the train. Ethan finds her and calls for help as he takes her off the train. Mindy is pissed off that she got it wrong again and says, fuck this franchise, which I guess was an ad-lib line.
Who left that she acknowledges that?
Yeah.
She thought she knew the killer in each one. Mindy doesn't have a lot to do in this one, but I like her a lot.
I like this, but again, Ghostface does not know how to hit vital organs in this movie, and it drives me insane.
A stomach shot is usually fatal, period.
Meanwhile, the rest of the group, they head to the theater, and Sam sends Danny away as he's not Woodsboro, as she says. He says he gets it, then he tells her to stay safe. And as they walk, Tara says, good call. Kirby gives the plan of turning the theater into a kill box and insists that they are safe here. Sam says that she's going to check in on Mindy to see if she's safe, and the camera keeps lingering on Kirby. We have a flash of Billy telling Sam that they're not safe, and he tells Sam to grab a weapon and make it safe. She grabs a knife and brandishes it as Billy says that's an excellent choice, his favorite. She walks through the theater as her phone rings. She answers, and Bailey says that they're all not safe. Kirby has been on a downward spiral since the Woodsboro murders from the previous year. In fact, according to him, she's no longer a member of the FBI. This is the point when I was like, fuck you, you're the killer.
This is when I knew that they had four different possible endings to this movie.
Sam runs to the gate and gets the elevator in a heightened state as we're hearing flashbacks to previous films, and she's fixated on a ghost face mural. Chad and Tara, they have another scene together as they kiss, and Tara says that he should have done that a whole lot sooner. Ghostface proves to be the ultimate cock block, though, as he attacks. Sam comes in and says Kirby is the killer, and Chad says, no shit. They see an exit door to the roof as Ghostface comes back and just wrecks havoc. Chad tells Ghostface to smile for the camera as he whacks him one. They run, and once again, Ghostface gets into a tizzy with Chad. He knocks Ghostface down as other Ghostfaces come and stab him down. Tara is affected, and they get surrounded by all the Ghostfaces. Sam screams, come on, motherfucker, as Kirby comes in firing shots. Bailey comes in and Kirby says to not listen to him. Bailey takes out Kirby, or so he thinks, and says, great job. And then we see that there are three ghost faces this time. He says that he expected more after what the two of them did to quote-unquote us. All right, so three ghost faces, another curveball in this film. Adam, how'd you feel about there being three ghost faces?
Three ghost faces? I'm okay with it. I thought there was going to be more. When they kept, I thought we were going to have a few more stepping out. I thought maybe we were going to have a cult of ghost face or something. Three ghost faces I'm okay with. Dot, dot, dot. But yeah, I'm good with having more than two for the first time.
I looked at it as the, you know, go bigger in the sequel. So go from two to three. Mm-hmm. And also, given this one has a lot of like New York geography you have to think about as far as like the planning of these kills. And given the, as we'll find out, sibling dynamic, having three actually tracks.
So we see the other two unmask, and we see that Mindy was right, as one of them is indeed Ethan, and that he was using the Nancy Loomis mask the entire time. And we find out that he's actually Bailey's son. And then we see the other one was Adam's favorite character of Quinn, the other roomie who supposedly died earlier. She says a little fake blood and prosthetic was all it took to fake you guys out.
You don't have such a massive scene like that and then have it be a fake out. The Jelly Belly factory wouldn't smell as sweet as that much freaking candy syrup. I mean, no, I just can't get on board with this.
Well, they put the same chick in three, too. We've seen the killer supposedly die and then come back later. It's not the first time they've tried pulling this, but you're saying this was just too much.
It's one thing to have them supposedly die. I mean, that happened to Billy in the first one, mm-hmm. You know, but to have this, you know, a body in a bathtub and gore and viscera everywhere, and then just be like, psych! No, fuck you.
Wow.
Well, it's a bathtub. It's psycho, not psych. you know, it's passable, but it kind of left me being like, oh, okay. Like, I was kind of indifferent to this one, to this set. Because now, all of a sudden, the acting goes full theater kid levels of absurdity from all three of them.
The acting level feels like the end of three all of a sudden.
Yeah, this turns into, like, two and three. Which makes sense, but I think a little bit of subtlety would have gone a long way.
They then pull out Billy's mask, and Bailey insists that Sam put on the mask. She bats it away, and Tara screams for them to stay the fuck away. Sam says that she didn't commit the murders, but Bailey says that they started the rumors. And Quinn says it's so easy to convince the world that Sam isn't the hero. She's the worst kind of person and not the best. Ethan chimes in that it's best to just assassinate the characters of those who think that they're heroes. And I tell you, I like this development a hell of a lot more than last week's film. You know, I'm liking that they're going after the character a lot like fandom went after her as an actress. So I like this call out. Adam, you're saying you don't.
No, the reasoning and stuff, that part I do. And it absolutely makes sense. So I'm okay with that.
You just hate the execution.
We don't like the execution, and I can't stand Quinn. I don't like the actress playing her, and I don't like the way that it's
personal.
I know.
There's something about, like, every line she delivers, I'm like, just go away.
Did you, like, have a bad Wendy's hamburger, and now you're again redhead, period?
And it's a redhead.
I was going to say, she's the redhead, dude. You got. I thought you were going to be defending her. Wow. All right.
I like the whole thing of the, it's not just bad enough, you have to, you know, denounce fiction, you have to go the extra mile of vilifying the individual who makes it or is involved. I mean, that's very clearly building upon last week, but taking it one step further, given the real life stuff that I have now been made aware of.
So Ethan lays out the plan, James Bond style, that she took matters into her own hands and she's a murderer like her father. He then lays out that she is a killer like her father, and that her brother died in Woodsboro at Sam's hand. We then hear a thunder clap, and then Sam puts together that Bailey is actually Richie's family. He said that when he saw what he'd done to Richie, he knew that she had to die.
This is also commentating on the whole, like, oh, it's never my kid's fault.
Yes.
Exactly. Oh, it's the media who drove them crazy, not the fact that the parenting wasn't great. This is very 90s of that looking for someone to blame.
Uh-huh.
Which the last one did as well. That was Amber's kind of like desperate plea at the end, although they saw right through it. So I thought this was fine.
To have an entire family turn homicidal, yeah, I don't know.
That's the stretch. If it was just Bailey, the dad.
Yeah, exactly.
He says that all of it is dark, which doesn't hide Bailey's actual love for his son. He says there was a bond between him and Richie, and we hear that this is actually Richie's collection that they're in. He says that he built a tribute to his son, and he needs for Sam to die amongst everything he loved the most. He says afterwards he's going to head to the hospital to make sure everyone who had to do with the death of his son suffers and dies. And Sam then calls Richie a pathetic man baby who had his girlfriend do all his killing and who cried before she slit his throat. As much as I've been harsh on Melissa Barrera these last two films, I just don't buy her as a final girl in these movies. I do like this moment that she has. This was good stuff. A fight breaks out and Quinn is taken down, and Kirby tells Sam to fuck them up. Tara and Sam climb up the theater as shots ring out, and Sam has a hold of Tara as she's starting to fall. Ethan says he's always wanted to stick something in Tara as he wings his knife her way, and she screams, fuck you. Sam sees a ghost face in the distance and wrestles with what this movie has been pushing as its theme. Does she or doesn't she let Tara go? She's approached from all angles as Tara tells her, let me go. Which Sam does, and Tara falls right into Ethan. She then takes Ethan completely out as she tells him to die a fucking virgin, which was funny.
And again, he gets up later after this. I'm like, he should be fucking dead after this.
The way she does, like, that it takes the time for this stab. Oh, you know, I've complained about the shoulder stabs, the leg stabs, and the stomach stabs that everybody lives from. I guess I should be complaining about this one. In the mouth?
Oh. Yeah. Meanwhile, Sam tells Quinn that she's down another fucking brother as she shoots her in the face. So there she goes, Adam. Your favorite character.
Does she?
Bailey then approaches as Sam says, you always have to shoot them in the head. But she's out of bullets as her and Bailey go at it and fall on the glass table below. They wake up, and as Bailey walks around, he gets a call. He answers it, and we get a Ghostface voice saying that he has one question for Bailey, and that's what his favorite scary movie is, as he's in one now. Bailey fires some shots, and he screams into the phone that murder is in their blood. He says that he's the police officer. Who do you think they're going to believe? The response is whoever is still alive as Sam approaches in the Ghostface garb and takes Bailey down in a hail of stab wounds. She says she's better than her father as she looks at Tara and says that he did fuck with her family and takes him down.
Yeah, I guess it's appropriate we're talking about Star Wars because it's like poetry, it rhymes.
I don't know, man. I like the arc. I like the arc of Tara being let go here. Yeah, we should be doing Frozen. I like that arc, and I like the fact that Sam kind of takes matters into her own hands. And it does the whole Billy thing, which I hated last week, but she uses it to her advantage here, and she's actually taking matters into her own hands, which I like that concept. I like the way they pulled this off.
It's redundant to last week. It gets a little heavy-handed because of the outfit, but it fits with what this is supposed to be for her character. But I like seeing her just so aggressively stab the fuck out of somebody. It's good for her.
Tara thanks Sam, and she says that she's not okay, meaning that she will indeed go to therapy. We see them at a distance as that song from the first screen plays, and they sit. Tara says, thank you for letting me go, and Sam responds, I knew you would take care of yourself. They say that she will be in Tara's life, but only as much as she wants, as Tara says that they're going to get through this together. But we're not done, as Ethan attacks one more time, only for Kirby to save them and say, I saw that in a scary movie once. Fantastic. Danny approaches and says he called for more reinforcements as we go outside, and Kirby tells them that they're all a part of the same fucked up family and legacy doesn't have to be a bad thing. They pull Chad out alive as Tara kisses him, and Mindy comes and expresses regret over missing the fucking ending again. And then we cut to Sam looking at the mask her father has as Tara asks if she's coming. Sam drops the mask as credits roll on Scream 6.
It wrapped up kind of like the last one, just without Gail and Sydney sitting there.
Yeah, it's my thought as well. It's kind of like a redux of the last one. And I'm sorry, what's the name? She'd be fucking dead. Like, this is the one that took me completely out.
All right, scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Scream 6? Adam, go ahead, sir.
The movies have come a long way, and now they finally switch locations. Ghostface takes Manhattan. I think it was a good idea to switch it up. And I think this movie delivers in a lot of ways by being able to change locations and by the writer, director, teams kind of being unburdened for the first time. This movie delivers for a lot of that. The opening is fantastic, and it sets you off base. It kind of, you know, throws your equilibrium off. You don't know the way it's going to go, and the rest of this movie is that way, and I appreciate the heck out of it. I like the kills when we get kills. I like the violence. I like the gore. I think this really delivers as a thriller done that way. This movie's got some missteps, though, and I can't get over them. This killer rarely kills, and it pisses me off. At the end of this movie, this crew from the last film, they're all still alive. It's hard for me to say, ooh, I want more deaths. I want these people to die. It's a horror franchise. Some of these people need to die. Some of these people need to get killed off. And it's clear that some of them are only alive because of reshoots. It's clear that some of them are only alive because of ADR that gets done. And I, at the end of the day, that doesn't sit well with me. So that everybody is still here alive at the end. Even Chad. Like, you got a Chad and the dude lives. Even the boyfriend shows back up with a gaggle of cops just to show back up at the end. Like, that stuff, this movie was better than it until the ending. So I think the ending gets away, but this is a pretty dang good ride, man. This is exciting. It is shot really well. The lighting, the camera moves that it does, and the few characters that it does bring back, I'm excited to see come back. I think they do more with Kirby than they do with Gale, and that's kind of cool to see. This one's really solid. As much as the ending gets away, almost all these endings get away. But I think this is a damn good entry into this franchise. It's a solid 7. I know it's Scream 6, but this is a 7 for me. I was pleased with what they did here. And yeah, 7 on 10. Easily one of my more fulfilling watches.
Man, your wrap-ups always take me on a roller coaster. I think you're going to zig and then you zag. You gave this a 7 after saying how much you needed the kills. All right, 7 out of 10 from Adam. Matt, as the one who really praised last week's film, how do you feel about Scream 6, sir?
not quite as strongly as I did about the last movie, just because I don't think it quite has that feeling of almost like defibrillating the franchise, because this one came out so quickly afterwards. And this one's a little bit more preoccupied with just being a straightforward slasher movie than, you know, the meta whodunits that this franchise has been built upon. But weirdly, I don't say that as a negative, because as a straightforward slasher movie, if you can get past the fact that Ghostface doesn't know how to finish the job in a lot of instances, I think this one has a certain amount of tension and creativity with the viscera that a lot of these movies just haven't had. But I will say, I think sometimes, and I talked about this with Gail, they pull their punches with deciding who to off and who to keep around, because the only characters who die in this are people we are meeting for the first time, all things considered. It's enjoyable, but I kind of wish we had a little bit more, and part of this is just because they made it a year later. Scream 2 had already done the whole, like, picking at sequels and everything that comes associated with that, so there wasn't as much gold to mine from that particular area. But on the whole, I liked seeing Kirby come back, which surprised me. Not that I didn't like that character, but I was like, what can you do with her coming back? And they found a creative, if not unremarkable, way to bring her back. But to Adam's point, I just think the whole reveal with the ghost faces, it kind of loses some of its luster and goes a little too big for me. But all in all, had a lot of fun with this on rewatch. This one held up pretty well. I was worried about going back to this one. It's pretty damn good. It's just not... I think the last one had a little bit more on its mind. And because of that, I'm going to go a really strong 7 on 10 for number 6.
7 from Matt. You know, I want to kick off my wrap up by quoting Mindy and saying, I got it wrong again. Coming into this, I was not looking forward to it, especially after the experience of watching last week's film. Last week's review almost had Jen coming into the computer room and giving me heart meds because of how much I was screaming about how much I hated it. I shouldn't say hate. I was disappointed with that film. This one, from the get-go, from the opening scene, almost all the way to the end, I had a much better time than I was expecting, to the point where I want to call this the second best in the series behind Scream 1. I find the kills in this to be visceral and fun. Love the fall off the building. I really enjoy the opening kill. I think the finale, with the wrap-up being amongst a tribute to all the other Scream killers, was a really creative and fun place to go. I think there was a lot of thought put behind this. And you can say what you want about the three killers at the end. I didn't have too big of a problem with them all being related and being family, although it did put me in mind of like Texas Chainsaw when we did that series, and Fast and Furious, which Matt brought up. I will say I'm going to knock half a point down, though, because I had no idea that Gail actually ended up living through that. I was going to give this movie a huge amount of credit for killing her off, but apparently she lived. So it's going to get a half point down, which makes this a 7.5. To me, the best in the series since part one. All right. That leads only one, boys. Next week, Scream 7, Kevin Williamson back to direct. And Matt, in the press leading up to this, all I thought of is what you said in the very first podcast, in that this looks like it's going to be just a fucking dumpster fire of epic proportions. The reviews have not been good. I don't read reviews, but it's hard to not log onto your social media and see the headlines pop up as you scroll through. And I've seen quite a few pretty bad ones. I am still going in with a pretty open mind, especially after the fun time I had with this. Matt, what are you expecting when we get to Scream 7 next week?
I have no clue, to be honest, but the comp I have to use, I feel like I'm walking into Rise of Skywalker to a certain degree, where it's, they should call it Scream 7. Are you fucking happy now? Because we're, you know, you're bringing Nev Campbell back. You're bringing back the original creator, but this time he's in the director's chair, not only in the writing chair. You have a lot of production turmoil and director changes, you know, because remember, Kevin Williamson was not originally attached to direct this. It really kind of is a Rise of Skywalker thing. And quite frankly, the buzz on it, and I don't want to call it the boycotts because of situations we'll talk about next week. I'm going in arms folded, and I have minimal to no expectations. And that's sad, because I really, really, really liked the last two. But for reasons we'll talk about, I'm not optimistic.
Well, we mentioned the two people, you know, Lillard and David Arquette, didn't have praise for this film that I gave a 7.5 to. But you know who really liked it? Kevin Williamson. He found it to be extremely fun, and he really wanted to keep that tradition going. So it's funny that the originator of the series is trying to keep the tradition of what was brought up after he left. All right, Adam. Well, as the newbie to this last set of films, how are you feeling going into next week's Scream 7, sir? And are you going with your daughter?
If she can get her rewatches done, yes. Otherwise, I got to get this done so that we can. But even if not, her and I will go see it together even after we do our recording first. But she knows that she's got a few days that she's got to get caught up. I'm looking forward to it. I'm glad that I'm to a point where I get to see the new episode in theaters and I'm ready to go. I liked this one a lot, but I've seen the headlines a little bit. You kind of can't miss it. And I've seen them more mixed. And I'm okay with that because I think genre films need to have a mixed reaction. So maybe that everything's not glowing makes me happy. Second, fuck you, Deadline, for spoiling shit in your posting headings. So yeah, that I get spoiled on certain things before I can even get to see this. I swear to goodness, the media can't help but just spoil shit for clicks. And I am enraged by that. But I'm looking forward to this. I'm looking forward to seeing a Scream in a theater because I haven't seen one in a movie theater since 2. So I'm the old man sitting there probably with my Ghostface bucket of popcorn because I'm getting one. And yeah, can't wait for us to discuss it.
Yep, this will be a solo theatrical outing for me. Jen, much like a lot of fans, has boycotted this series. Like, she's just like, I'm not going. Not for reasons.
For different reasons. Jen doesn't like horror.
Yeah, not for reasons that a majority of people are doing. She just doesn't like this series. I'm going in, like I mentioned, with an open mind. I enjoyed this last one. And if I go in with my arms crossed like Adam, or like Matt is doing, well, I'm going to look like I did at the end of this one where I was like, wow, I'm not looking forward to that, but I really enjoyed it. Will the same happen next week? I am looking forward to our discussion. I'm looking forward to us revealing what we're going to be doing next and what the future of the site is going to look like. And there's some really exciting stuff coming down. I cannot wait to announce it to everybody. Thank you, everybody, for your support. Thank you for everything, all the positive words. Until next week when we get to Scream 7, looks like you're down another podcast. Thank you, boys.
The past will come back to bite you in the ass. Whatever you think you know about the past, forget it. The past is not at rest. Any sins you think were committed in the past are about to break out and destroy you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Wow. That was intense.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Watch a few movies, take a few notes. It was fun.
But us, we're gonna carry on and plan the sequel, cause let's face it, baby, these days, you gotta have a sequel!
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews, such as the Alien film series, the Pirates of the Caribbean film series, the Exorcist films, the Jaws franchise, the Predator films, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, the John Wick franchise, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Beetlejuice films, the Megan films, and so much more.
The reason I'm here is to help you.
Scream retrospective introduction performed by Adam and Sarai, directed by Garrett. Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
It could be fucking Reservoir Dogs by the time this thing is through.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
By definition alone, they're inferior films.
It's bullshit generalization. Many sequels have surpassed their original.
Oh, yeah?
Name one.
Yeah.
Aliens. Far better than the first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's no accounting for taste.
Thank you, Ridley Scott rules.
Scheduling done by Matt.
What did you just say?
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
This is all because of you.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
So how can I help you? Or do you want me to tell you who you look like?
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Now welcome to the final act.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
One too many movies.
Nah, Sid! Don't you blame the movies! Movies don't create psychos! Movies make psychos more creative!
So in closing, let me say, good luck, Godspeed, and for some of you, I'll see you soon.
God, this only came out a year later.
Wow. But we have three Scream movies in the span of like 3.5 years is Saw-ish in its go.
Nice. That is pretty Saw-ish. Wow, another one. This one made a lot of money. Jesus, no wonder why they keep making them.
Like that, titties used to be a part of horror. And for something that deconstructs it that way, it's the type of thing that you realize isn't there until they're making a joke about sex sounds and not sex.
And titties had their time.
Or dong.
And not really.
Not since what, Shame? I think it's the last time I saw dong in a film.
You need to watch.
No, I don't. Quinn tells
the Seven Kingdoms.
Quinn tells Sam that. So we're getting some plot here, right, Adam?
Yeah, we're getting our third act information. We're getting what we need to know for the end.
Go ahead.
It's not.
So at least they mentioned the mom, right?
Yeah, I mean, but it's a little retroactive. The million-dollar question is, Gail, what's wrong with your face? God damn, every time it's distracting.
It is. I know. Yeah.
Like from 4 on, it almost looks like she looks like Leatherface.
I know.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Neve Campbell, she's getting up there, but she I don't think she's had any work done.
I don't think so either. Gail
and David Arquette should get some work done because he looks like shit.
Gail says, "Fuck her." And then we see the other one was Adam's favorite character of Quinn, the other roomie who supposedly died. Earlier, she says a little fake blood and prosthetic was all it took to fake you guys out. So, Adam,
lazy, sorry.
Go ahead.
You didn't even get to get it out.
No.
You don't have...
All right, that's enough. That'll be a wrap. The sequel discussion to be continued.